Astronomy 101 for November. Okay, let's see.
Wow.
Okay, let's see. It's about control. You can't be in a situation where your position of authority undermines the relationship that you have between you and whoever you're dealing with. Yeah, control. That's why teachers shouldn't be involved with their students. You see, because we're all control freaks. Lab, your next lab, probably your last lab.
Really?
And yeah, because the next thing is your simulation activity.
Do you know what day the last day of school is?
When it's over.
Oh, no, like,
I have no idea.
I don't know.
No, I just keep coming until you stop, and then I know it's over.
So if we all stop showing up.
Then I think it's over. But no. Here's why: because I have a test. I look at my grade book on a computer, and I say, "Oh, they're missing these assignments, so it can't be over. So they're fooling me."
So if you give us every single piece of work we have for the rest of the day, but the rest of the semester right now, and we turn it in on Monday, and then we're done.
If you do it and turn it on Monday, then I'll be suspect of how you got it done and if it's quality or not, based on what you did in the past. Now, if in the past you worked that quickly, that would be fine. This lab deals with you're putting together the refraction reflection lab, and deals with telescopes. Okay, and this is due probably next week is good. Next Wednesday. Oh, that's right. So then the following Monday, how's that? Don't worry, I have enough for everyone. Get some more. Let's see. Sorry. Okay, here we go.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Is this our lab?
This is lab 8. Yeah, this is the one on telescopes. So when you go online to get your answer sheet, you look for the one that says telescopes, lab 8.
All right.
Okay. Everyone get one? I forgot you were in the back. There you go.
Thank you.
You're welcome. There you go.
Yeah, I can be had for the answer.
Okay, now. All right, Richard's not here today, huh? Okay. Any questions? All right, lights. Let's see. 59 years ago. No, that's not right. 49 years ago. Yeah, that's better. 49, 9. And that's... No, that's not right.
It'd be 1960.
49 years ago is 1960. So it would be 40... 42... 40... Whoa, 50? Yeah, 52 years ago. 52 years ago. Wow. What happened 52 years ago? I'm going to tell you. We're going to talk about the space program. The first satellite.
Sputnik, September 7th?
Yeah, October. The 4th of October. 52 years ago. The first artificial satellite was sent up by the Russians. It was called Sputnik 1.
Wait, was it Sputnik
2? Yeah. Sputnik 1. Sputnik in Russian apparently means traveling companion. The traveling companion of the Earth. Now, mind you, we had the science knowledge, the scientific knowledge, to do this when Isaac Newton came up with all his ideas on motion and forces. What we didn't have was the technology. Newton actually wrote about what you needed to do to put an object in orbit around the Earth. And he had a little diagram in the Principia, a little cannon on the Earth, and a series of curves. If the velocity was just right, the thing would curve right around the Earth because it would fall around the Earth and not hit the Earth. So the concepts were understood back then. During the Civil War, there was some talk about the Confederates possibly having launched an object. And it was based on the fact that the Confederates are rather interesting, that part of the country. I guess when you're down and out and you really got to dig deep to come up with different ideas, they did. I mean, they came up with submarine and all sorts of interesting stuff. But one of the things, they were playing around with rockets. And the story goes that one of their rockets was launched, and they never found it. So the idea was, oh, maybe it went into orbit. But, yeah, when I was a kid, I built a rocket, too, and I couldn't find it, so I told everybody it went into orbit. So you can always do that, I guess. But there's an interesting story, if you Google it, you know, you'll find the Confederate rocket that went into orbit or whatever, and there's always somebody who's got an explanation, and that sort of makes sense. Yeah?
The Germans never put anything in orbit?
No. Well...
Because all of them von Braun stuff...
Yeah, we're going to talk about that, and we're going to see exactly what was going on there. Because we're going to have to step backwards. But in the 4th of October, 1957, is when this happened. And... the USSR, which doesn't exist anymore, it's just Russia now, launched the first artificial satellite. And they took advantage of the hysteria during this time. There was the so-called Cold War. And when they picked the orbit that they wanted this to go in, they made sure it went right over Washington, D.C., right up the east coast of the United States, where most of the population is. And if you were an adult and you went out and saw this thing, you probably shook in your boots. But if you were a kid, like me, went out and looked at it, you thought, hey, that's cool.
Yeah?
I mean, that's the coolest thing. Look at that. We actually did all the science fiction stuff. We're actually in space. So from a kid's point of view, wow, and a lot of kids got fired up and went into studying science as a result of that. And but they had the prize, and they put a little beeper in it, a little transmitter, so that if you were a radio amateur and you can dial in the frequency, you could hear it beep, beep, beep as it went overhead. And I saw Sputnik. You see Sputnik?
I don't think I saw it.
I saw Sputnik. I went outside specially. They said that Sputnik would be passing over Rhode Island on such and such a time. I went outside the end of my father's driveway, and I watched it. And it was cool because it was the only thing in the sky that's moving. And it was pretty bright. It was not too big physically, but it was highly reflective. And when the sun was just right, just like when you see the space station or the space shuttle, and you just get the right sun angle, you get a nice glint off of it. And you could see this thing just moving along, and it's like, wow, that's cool. People actually put that in orbit. And of course, the politicians were saying, the Russians put it in orbit, the high ground, you know, military, they can put anything in orbit now. And the Russians did pick up something rather heavy. This thing weighed 184 pounds. You say, well, that's not very much. Well, we'll see when compared to what we did. But before we move on, we've got to go back a little bit. We've got to go back to toward the end of World War II. And during that time, first of all, Hitler was very interested in technology. And probably one of the reasons the Germans lost the war is that Hitler essentially bankrupted the country. He was very interested in all the new stuff. They developed jet engines, jet planes, all right? They were working on the atomic bomb. They were working with rockets. And they had the V-1 rocket, the buzz bombs that they would send over to England and bomb England pretty good. And then we would fly over Germany and bomb them pretty good. So, and now everybody's friends, at least for a while. And they were on top of the pile in terms of using rocket technology. Well, they had a base called Peenemünde. And at Peenemünde, what they would do is, that's their rocket place, they would develop their rockets. One of the people whose names pop up was a guy named Wernher von Braun. We've got to go back a little further back in time, toward the end of the 1800s. And during that time period, there was a huge interest worldwide about things astronomical and the possibility of life out there. And there were amateur rocket societies. Almost every major country had one. Had people playing around with rockets. The War of the Worlds was written around that time. H.G. Wells wrote that book. So there was an interest in such things. Well, in Massachusetts, there was a young kid by the name of Robert Goddard. And he would hang out in his favorite tree, a cherry tree on his aunt's property, and he would look up at night at Mars and imagine what it would be like to go to Mars. That was one of his goals. And he kept that in his head all while he was growing up, and he went into school and studied mathematics and physics and became a physics professor. And then he did something that people who are interested in doing such things did. He started building rockets. But the rockets that he built were not just like skyrockets with black powder. He built rockets using liquid fuel. And this was the first time that was done. He went through a series of very elaborate and well thought out experiments with his rockets. In other words, changing different parameters one at a time to see how it affected the flight of his rockets. And he did this on his aunt's property in Massachusetts. And he ultimately couldn't do it there anymore. I mean, it caused fires, and he didn't have enough land to launch these things. So he got a place out in New Mexico. And during the summer, you're smiling. You thought of that? And he got a place out in New Mexico, and in the summers he would come out with his various rockets. He would hire some of the local people, machinists and stuff, to work on these projects, and they were sworn to secrecy because the other thing that he did was interesting is he got patents on all his inventions that had to do with liquid fuel rockets. And one thing led to another, and his series of experiments were well documented. He photographed, took movies of all his experiments, and he had patents on everything. The idea was, once he perfected this, he would sell this to the government or whatever and make money and ultimately be able to fulfill his dream going to Mars. Well, during this process, he published a couple of articles, and he was already starting to get some ridicule from individuals in the scientific community, and people saying, the New York Times gave him a big whack and said, any idiot knows that rocket engines won't work in space because they need something to push against. Obviously, these people didn't understand physics, but what else is new? And here you have his goal to go to Mars is now curtailed, we'll just go to the moon. So he would talk about going to the moon, he would give lectures on how this would be done, and on and on. At around the same time, there's a young kid in Germany named Werner von Braun. This is Ida Weyer's naive history again, all right? But it gets to the point. This young kid in Germany playing around with little rockets, and one of the stories goes that one day he was he built one, put on his wagon, and sent the wagon down through the village and knocked over the fruit stands and stuff, and his father gave him a whack for that. And but he was interested in rockets. And there were a number of people around the world at that time. But these are two prominent names. Well, Werner von Braun grew up, and ultimately during the World War II, the Nazis came to power, and they were recruiting bright kids to be part of this movement. And Werner von Braun signed up because now he could get his education and can learn what he wanted to do, and became rocket scientist. And he didn't like too much what the Nazis were up to, but he figured, I need to know my science. So he studied about rockets, and he had a prominent position in the government, and would work at Peenemünde. Now, Peenemünde was the factory workers there. Many of them, if it would be the equivalent of slave labor, there would be people that were, if you didn't get to the gas chamber, maybe you got to work at Peenemünde. So it was sort of like that. And so there were a number of people there. They didn't know what they were dealing with. They just, you do this, okay, you do that, okay. And they were assembling these rockets and firing them, and some worked, some didn't. And again, the Germans are very, very fastidious when it comes to recording data, so they got lots of data. Well, during the end of the war, everybody knew Germany was just about done. Russia was our ally, and now we're making advances toward Germany. We're going to overrun Germany and take it over. And Peenemünde was one of the prizes. So essentially, you got the German scientists of Peenemünde know it's coming. They literally packed everything up. I mean, they just sat there and waited. And so here comes the Americans, here comes the Russians, and they get to Peenemünde, and there's no resistance. And so they process the scientists, and literally the Russians and the Americans chose up sides and say, okay, you take this guy, we'll take this guy. And both the U.S. and Russia ended up with the German rocket scientists. One of the guys we ended up with was Werner von Braun. And they confiscated all their hardware, and from the American point of view, we took all that stuff to New Mexico, White Sands, and continued the experiments, and the German scientists were able to continue the experiments. The Russians got their German scientists, and just like the Russians, you think of them as vroom, 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 they started building big rockets right off the bat. We were still playing around with little stuff. The German scientists had a tough time because Germany wasn't in high regard at the time. So there was a lot of prejudice against them in terms of, what are you really up to? But they knew what they were doing. Werner von Braun had a goal, and he was a very clever showman, in a sense. He could sell you his ideas. I remember when I was a kid watching Walt Disney World, or The Wonderful World of Disney, and Werner von Braun would be on periodically talking about what we're going to do to go to the moon, and his rocket designs, because he designed rockets. And he ultimately designed the Apollo rocket that brought us to the moon. Well, what's curious about all this is when the German scientists were asked at Peenemünde, where did you get all this technology? Where did you learn how to do this? I mean, this is really good stuff. And the German scientists looked puzzled and said, what are you talking about? They said to the Americans, we got this from the patents of Robert Goddard. Because he already did. I mean, he designed how the cryogenic fuels would be pumped. He designed the pumps, the mechanism to steer the rockets. So all the designs of the German scientists were based on Robert Goddard's stuff. The government, the U.S. government at the time, just turned their back on it and said, we don't need rockets. What do you need rockets for? They said the same thing with the airplane, the Wright brothers. People went to France and they started building them there, and then they catch up. So very, very interesting twist of fate. So the Russians had their guys, and we had our guys, and now, of course, the Russians, they weren't too happy with the way situation in the world was. So now we've got this Cold War that's going on. Well, in the 50s, you have very interesting stuff going on. It was fun growing up in the 50s. When you were in elementary school, now you have fire alarms. We used to have air raid drills. Now you'd be sitting at your desk, and then all of a sudden the air raid siren would go off, and it was called duck and cover. And because we were going to be bombed by the Russians, and of course the kids there probably did the same thing, and we're going to bomb them. So this thing of the atomic age was crazy. So when the Russians launched that first satellite at 184 pounds, okay, this was a big weight to put into orbit at the time. But again, their German rocket scientists and the Russians started right away building these big rockets. And we went in these little stages, little steps, one at a time. And if someone, you heard about the Iron Age, the Bronze Age, all these ages of humanity. This is the beginning of the Space Age. So we actually have a date when an age began, and that's right here, the 4th of October, 1957. So now, not too long thereafter, Sputnik 2 was sent up. And this was, its anniversary was yesterday, the 3rd of November, 1957. And what was different about this is that there was a dog on Sputnik 2, and the dog's name was Laika. And
a dog from back to Earth?
No. But when the Russians would do anything space-wise, they're very secretive, and if it worked and it was successful, then they'd make a big deal about it to show how superior they were to the American way. And there's an interesting story behind this. Why send a dog, first of all? Well, they want to see if living things can live in orbit. And you say, well, we already know that. But in 1957, you didn't know that. You had no idea. As far as you were concerned, you can only live in a gravity environment on Earth. All right? We had no idea if living things could make it in orbit around the Earth. So you needed to test it. So they went out, the story goes, and they found a stray dog in Moscow and just picked him up. Yeah, you look pretty good. And they trained the dog to sit still and to work in a harness. In other words, they had to keep the dog chained so the dog could stand and sit. It couldn't turn around because it was in a small capsule. And they connected the dog to some, what's the word I want, like a toilet system, right? And the food would come out to the dog in the form of gel, so it would give the dog its nutrition and its water. And the dog went up, had telemetry attached to it, so they could monitor the dog's heartbeat, its respiration, and all the vital things that you need to know about a living organism in space. And at the time they had, I don't know if they still have it, the weekly reader for elementary kids, they still have that? But you know what I'm talking about? It's a little newspaper for kids. And they had a picture of Laika on the front page of the newspaper saying, oh, dog went into space. But the teacher didn't tell you, dog didn't come back. But so they, you put the cheery face on it, and there's the dog like that with the space suit and without the helmet or whatever the rest of it was. But this dog you know, you have to have like a monument. There's an old story about in Italy, this Renaissance story, where an architect was going to build a bridge across one of the rivers, and it was very difficult to do. And so he made a pact with the devil and said to the devil, if you help me build this bridge, you know, I'll do whatever you want. And the devil said, sure, no problem. I'll help you build the bridge. So the bridge was built, and the guy asked the devil, well, what do you need in return? He said, well, I want the soul of the first human who walks over the bridge. And the architect said, no problem. So what he did was he found a dog, and he let the dog go over, and the devil didn't know the difference. So a dog, in myth, in Italian, saved humanity or taught humanity something. So Laika, the same deal. They sent this dog up. The dog was in orbit, several orbits around the Earth, but probably only lived for 5 or 7 hours once it got up. It overheated. One of the shrouds that covered the capsule didn't disengage to help control the heat in the cockpit or the capsule. So the temperature kept going up and up and up, and the dog just died from overheating. But they had no mechanism to bring the dog down in one piece anyway, so it was probably best because you would just burn up on the way in. But what is interesting is this whole process took about a month when they decided they were going to do this. And that was it. I mean, they got the dog. The dog was put in its little harness on the launch pad for a day before it even went anywhere. And I can't even imagine what it'd be like to be chained in one position, not knowing what's going on. But the dog lifted off. They got, you know, the heartbeat went up, like we understand it will now. But it settled back down when the dog was weightless, and apparently the dog was happy for a while until it just went unconscious and died from overheating. So Laika was the first living thing up, and that sent interesting shivers up everybody's spine. Here you go, 184 pounds. That's the weight of a person. Right, and now you can keep something alive in orbit. Right, so now this is giving chills to the Americans, because the next step is put a person up there. So all right, we're going to respond. Well, in the meantime, Wernher von Braun, being very clever and knowing that he was getting a lot of resistance when he would submit his proposals to the Navy, I guess they were involved with a lot of this first stuff. They were looked at and sort of put on the shelf and not given to the German scientists. They were nasty people, right? So Wernher von Braun, when he's working on the stuff he did get money for, would duplicate all the orders. So he was building a rocket while he was building what the government said that they wanted. So he sort of had in the warehouse everything he needed for what eventually became the rocket that first worked for us. Because the stuff that they were working on wasn't very good, and he knew what the problems were. So, and he knew he wasn't going to get funded until he could prove that his designs were better, and he knew that was never going to happen. So he sort of played the system a little bit and said, I need two of these. And what do you need two for? Well, nobody knew, because nobody knew about rockets. You know, there were a small group of people. Again, Ida Weiss is naive history, but it basically tells you the story. And then we finally sent up Explorer 1. And this went up on the 31st of January, 1958. This was the U.S. launch. And this was our first satellite. And our first satellite weighed a whopping 2 pounds. And we immediately, from the very beginning, there was a side of our space program that was very open, and everyone knew what was going on. And we advertised before we launched so the world could participate in what was happening. And our idea was, apparently, politically, is we don't have to do anything in secret. We're just going to show you right out front. And the first couple of launches before this weren't too great. And on TV, you see the rockets sitting there going, and nothing happens. Or they go, boom. and blow up. And I would be running home from school to watch all of these launches. All right, that was my big thing. I'd be running home. I wanted to see all these launches. And finally, this one went. But the other thing that was interesting about our space program from the beginning is that we had a scientific component to it. All right, the Russians were doing the same thing here, but from the beginning, and we don't know how many things that didn't work, all right, because we're finding out now because the barriers are broken down. We can talk a little bit more about it. But we went ahead and started doing some science. And one of the things we discovered in our early launches are the so-called Van Allen radiation belts. And these are areas around the Earth that are formed essentially by the Earth's magnetic field, which deflects all this stuff that comes off the sun, that if we didn't have a magnetic field, we wouldn't be here. We just couldn't live on the planet. We wouldn't have evolved to this, to where we are. So that was the beginning. Van Allen predicted these, a guy named Van Allen, and when they sent the satellite up, it went through portions of it, and they saw an increase in activity with the Geiger counters they'd have on board, and everyone said, wow, that's cool. So we then say the race for space began. Well, as we now know, there really was no race. The Russians had some very severe technical problems along the way that set them back. But what they did do is that they had a goal and they just kept at it. And the first goal that they had was to be the first nation to send a human in space. And they did. So we say the first manned flights. Now, we say manned because they were manned by men. So that's just the way it is. Except we'll see that the Russians are going to show us their superiority, and their communist system was far superior, so everyone was equal, so they actually went and launched the woman. I'll tell you that story shortly. But the first guy that went up...
Very good.
The first guy that went up, Yuri Gagarin. Well, first we've got to look at the techniques. Okay, we're going to look at USSR and we're going to look at USA. These are techniques that they had to work with. Okay, the USA, we were in the, because our rockets were smaller, we had to make everything smaller. We had to miniaturize all the components that were necessary. So essentially, the lifting capability of our rockets forced our technology in another direction, which we all benefit from today in terms of microelectronics, integrated circuits, lasers came later. But just anything that we have today came out of this thinking. The Russians, on the other hand, started off with big rockets. For example, if they needed to launch a refrigerator, they'd go to the store, buy a refrigerator, and put it on a rocket, make it big enough, powerful enough to launch the refrigerator. It wasn't a big deal. If we wanted to launch a refrigerator, we had to make the refrigerator small. All right, so all the components had to be reduced. And that also followed in terms of the electronics, the control systems. So we had miniaturization and the Russians' standard scale. Okay, so we end up with, say, things like microelectronics. Okay, and systems. And the Russians, you know, they just went with what they had. Now, this was why they didn't make it to the moon first and why there really wasn't a race. And this gave us an edge in the long run, because the other thing that we did was we were very careful, and probably more than we had to be. And today it's ridiculous when you see what we do. But during this time, a lot of the rockets that we used were designed not to launch people, but to launch atomic bombs at Russia. They were the intercontinental ballistic missiles. And so we didn't really care how fast they left the launch pad. We didn't bother worrying about the acceleration a living thing would deal with. But that's what we had, so that's what we used. And von Braun was working on a series of different rockets. But that's what we had. We had the most reliable one, the Mercury rockets, Redstone rockets that we use in Project Mercury. I've been to Florida to the Space Center years ago, and I was amazed. I actually got to see the launch pads where, when I was a kid, I watched on TV. And on TV, you see this rocket standing there, and it's like, wow, look at that. That's cool. They used an oil derrick with an arm on it to have access to the rockets. I mean, it was really... It was not a well-funded program. They used whatever they had. When I got down here...
What's that say in the USA?
Miniaturization, microelectronics systems. When I got down to see where the Mercury rockets were fired, the Redstone rockets were fired, it was like, really? There was a concrete pad, probably about from that wall to that wall, square, and in the middle of it was a thing looked like a spike with a cone on it. That was the blast deflector, right? And the rocket stood on there on a stand with an old oil gantry where they use for oil wells, and that held it up. And that was it. And the rocket, you could take two people, put your arms around it like that. And on top of that, they put a capsule, and they stuck the first astronauts that we sent up. When the Russians did this, they put a guy up, Yuri Gagarin, first person in space that we know of, but they may have had some failures that they didn't talk about, and still don't. He was 27 years old. He was a military test pilot. He was the first person to orbit the Earth. This was the 12th of April, 1961. So he was in orbit for 108 minutes. Okay, he made an orbit and a half or so and came down. Our answer to him was a guy named Alan Shepard. And he did a 15-minute suborbital flight. In other words, he went up and down like that. Okay, he didn't go in orbit. That was our first response. And this was on the 5th of May. So you see, like, one does one thing and then we follow. But the Russians, you know, Alan Shepard was sitting on the launch pad so long, because they've got to test everything, he peed his pants, literally. He had to go to the bathroom. And they have all sensors on the astronauts, and he's sitting there and sitting there and sitting there hours, hours. He says, look, guys, can I get out? I've got to go. And they said, no, can't, because we don't know when everything's just right. We'll send you. And he said, well, that's too bad. And he just peed his spacesuit. And all the sensors went, that's the story about Alan Shepard. But they finally launched him, and he made a suborbital flight. He didn't go in orbit, he just went up and into the ocean, splash, like that, 15-minute ride. Right after that, the second Russian, German Titov, he did 17 orbits. This was a full day in space. And then our answer to him was John Glenn. Did you hear that name?
Mm-hmm.
All right, good. So you know John Glenn. And his was on the 20th of February, 1962. And he only made one orbit. He was supposed to make three. But what happened, one of the sensors on the capsule, now these capsules were for one person, they were essentially, they used to call them spam in a can. the astronauts called them. Right? Look like that. And so a person would sit in here. And that was it. They actually had to fight to have the engineers put a periscope in so they could look out. Because these people, these were test pilots. The engineers didn't care. They just want to put a person in orbit. And so the test pilots got a little annoyed with this because they want to play with things. You know, they got to control stuff. And so there was this big, right from the beginning, hassle between the engineers and the astronauts, the test pilots, because they said, just keep the monkeys going, because they were sending monkeys up before them, and they brought them back, right? So we brought them back, and that's sort of an important part. If you're going up, you want to come back, right, in one piece. It's a nice idea. So on the back of these things, they had retro rockets, and they were attached with steel bands, essentially. And at a certain point, just before, what they would do to come back into orbit, you have to slow down. So the capsule would then turn, and this would be the forward direction of the capsule as it was going to come down. And then you slowed it down by turning on these rockets, and they'd fire for a little bit, a few seconds or so. And once you used up the fuel, a projectile, at this point the capsule, was now going slow enough, it'd fall back into the Earth and into the atmosphere. So right behind this was the heat shield. And this rocket pack was supposed to be jettisoned, and then just the heat shield hits the atmosphere. Well, there was a sensor on board that said the heat shield was coming loose. And they didn't know if the sensor was giving real data or if it was just an error in the technology. So to be safe, they said, well, keep this attached. But they didn't design this to work in the atmosphere, hitting the atmosphere attached. So they were taking a chance. Now they cut them short, two orbits. That doesn't make any sense. You could have left them up there as long as you wanted to, because it didn't matter if there was a problem or not. You know, you can get more data. But they decided to send them back. He came in. Now, when these things re-enter the atmosphere, and the space shuttle still does this too, but the problem is gone because we have satellites. As this thing enters the atmosphere, it heats up several thousand degrees, and the heat shield is called an ablative heat shield. What that means is, as it gets hot, it's like the bark on pine trees. When a forest fire goes by, you look at pine trees' bark, it's like in pieces. And the idea that nature has is when you heat this up and start to burn the bark, it falls away and it carries the heat with it. See? So the ablative heat shield is the same way. As this gets hot, the pieces fall off and carry the heat away. And you make it thick enough, and if you did the calculations and didn't screw up with the numbers, you make it thick enough so once it's all gone, you're done producing all this heat. But around you, you produce this ionic field, and you can't transmit radio signals down to Earth for about 5-7 minutes during this process. You could transmit out here, but we didn't have satellite up. Now we have, with the space shuttle, we can talk all the way down to the ground. So here comes John Glenn with an unproven design now. Hits the atmosphere, says, yeah, I'm in the atmosphere, it's a rough ride, and then the radio goes dead. And nobody knows what happened to him until he finally gets into the atmosphere, slows down, and parachutes come out. Now he's talking to the ships that are going to pick him up, and when he's dropping in the Atlantic. So national hero, John Glenn. He never flew again. He didn't like that. Now, the idea was, we can't lose our national hero. This is NASA. NASA's always this big, what it seems. I mean, they were ahead of the politicians, the way the politicians now, they've got to look a certain way. They were ahead of them. And we can't lose our national hero. They have big ticker tape parade in Washington, in New York. And there's John Glenn, and he was pissed. Well, he stayed around for a while, and then he went into politics, and he ended up being a senator, I guess, from Ohio, yeah. And, so John Glenn's out there. He had some problem that they said he had some equilibrium problem with his ear. He fell in his bathtub when he came back down after a week or two. So they figured out he's off on medical. But he was still flying. And, I mean, the guy, he's in his 70s. He still flies, as far as I know. High-performance jets, that's what he flew all the time. So they, we jump forward a little bit, and a few years ago, John Glenn went up in the space shuttle. It was sort of his, all right, we're sorry, John, we screwed you over. So, and the excuse they gave is that he was going to do geriatric experiments in space. He was in better shape than the young astronauts. He was keeping up with them. They couldn't believe it. But he got to go into space again. And what's really interesting here is when I was a kid, I heard John Glenn's flight. I was in front of the TV again. And when he went up in the space shuttle, guess where I was? I was in Mission Control in Houston, watching his heartbeat on a little monitor, because he was asleep when I was there. It was just so cool. It's like this, you know, connection. But to see that, and of course he was very happy about it. In Houston they had a big parade, and they all up and down the main highway by the Space Center they had flags and things, and John Glenn's name. However, what you don't hear about are the women that they had who were astronauts. And there was another one, she's still around, and she should have gone up in a space shuttle too. But you can't have a woman die in space, you see. That was the idea why they didn't have female astronauts at the very beginning. These women were very competent. They were, during World War II, guess who used to fly the airplanes over to Europe? Mm-hmm. The women pilots, because where are all the guys? They're already there. So how do you get the planes over? Well, you fly them. So there was a whole air corps of women that they selected and actually had during the initial phases of the space program. They had a women's astronaut corps, but it was for show. So finally, with the advent of the space shuttle, we now have women astronauts and pilots. Women routinely fly the shuttle back down. You'll have women pilots flying the shuttle down. So those things have changed. But during this time, the Russians were going to show how superior their system was, and communism was equal, everybody was the same, blah, blah, blah. So what they did, sort of like when they found Laika walking around the street, they went into a factory one day, and they looked at the people working there, and they looked at a woman and says, "You, come with us for the fatherland." However they would say things. Oh, she was, okay, I guess so. Why? You'll see. I devise naive history. Well, what did they do with this woman? She was a factory worker. All right. Now, all the cosmonauts, test pilots, astronauts, test pilots. This woman's a factory worker. They took her and literally, in a sense, put a spacesuit on her. No training whatsoever. Wasn't a pilot, so you figure, well, she has some idea of what it's going to feel like, you know, or unusual attitudes. They stuck her in a capsule, and they put her in orbit. She made three orbits. She now tells the story. She said she was thought she was going to die. She screamed all the time she was in orbit. She comes back down. They have one picture of her, like, and that's what they published to the world. And then you don't hear from her anymore. All right? She's still alive, I think. But Google first Russian woman in space, and you'll get an earful. So they put a woman in orbit right away, right around this time, but not very well thought out. So we had Project Mercury. This is when one astronaut would go up at a time. And again, we had a process, but there was a lot of political stuff you had to deal with. One of the things that makes our ability to explore on this scale iffy is our political system, because it depends on who's in charge and whether or not they like this idea. So they either give you money or they take money away. Right? We were supposed to be going to the moon. We're not going to the moon. Not for a long time, unless things change. So the Russians, they just kept at it. You know, their system was, who cares? We want to do this. This is what we're going to do. Didn't matter how much it cost, they were going to do it. And as a result, they were very secretive, and they did suffer some very major catastrophes on their launch pads, because their rockets were big, again, from the get-go. They had a rocket that could go to the moon. It was powerful enough. The proton rockets, I believe they called it, the name. And They were massive things, and one of them actually exploded on the launch pad they didn't tell anybody, and it killed out probably half of their rocket scientists and engineers, and set their sights on the moon back a ways. I mean, they were ready. They landed on the moon before we did with a probe. Okay, they actually took moon rocks back to the Earth, so they knew how to do it, and we got there first. Well, the lunar landing. President Kennedy. May 25th, 1961, gave a speech in Texas. Very famous speech. And again, this was a different time. You know, 40-odd years, 50 years ago, the country was still naive, you know, in many ways. You had people who were politicians who really cared about the country and about making progress. You had schools that were really educating kids. People could spell correctly, put two words together in a sentence. And it was fine. Kennedy makes this speech in 1961. Okay, you know, he was killed a couple of years after that. But he makes this speech. And in this speech he says, by the end of the decade, by the end of the 1960s, we will land a man on the moon, take him back safely. Okay? And we'll do it not because it's easy, but because it's hard. You don't hear anybody talk like that today. You gotta do things because they're easy. If it's hard, I don't want to do it. We didn't even have the technology in 1961 to build the vehicles that were gonna go to the moon. You see, this is ballsy here. You make a speech like that, and you tell everybody, this is what we're going to do. Okay, how are we going to do it? We're going to give you money to do it. Every single state in this country was involved in the space program. I grew up in Rhode Island. You say, well, Rhode Island, little state, what did they do? There was a seamstress factory that was owned by a couple of women. They made the patches that went on the spacesuits. Okay, like everybody had something to do with this, and it was a goal. It was set up. Now, the last time this happened, Bush tried to say we're going to go to Mars, but he didn't. No money. All right, but we're going to go to Mars. Everybody getting say we're going to go to Mars, but it wasn't. It wasn't serious. It wasn't funded. All right, and then the other Bush, the next guy. We're going to go back to the moon. And we were ready to do it. The Ares rocket, they were just fired off, you know. That was part of that whole thing. We're going to be on the moon in 2012. That was the plan. That's gone. Forget that. But in 1961, we didn't have the technology. This guy makes this speech. And in 1969, in July, we landed on the moon. Now, this is not without price we had to pay. All right? We lost three astronauts during this process. There was a fire on the launch pad. And three astronauts, one of which was Gus Grissom, who was in the Mercury program, and they said he lost the space capsule. And he was sort of looked at, you know, oh, the astronaut loses his space capsule. He opened this hatch too soon and it flooded because they all landed in the ocean then. And he said, I didn't open my hatch. Something went wrong. The hatch blew open. And they couldn't prove it one way or another until a few years ago. The Discovery Channel went down and got his space capsule and picked it up. And just like he said, he didn't pull the handle. It was still there, ready to be pulled to blow the hatch. So something went wrong. And so they finally put him in a team that was going to go to the moon, because they tried to get all the original guys and get them up there at some point. And he and two astronauts, Gus Grissom and White and Chaffee, were in the capsule training, the capsule that was being built to go to the moon, and there was a fire. They use 100% oxygen environment. The astronauts are breathing 100% oxygen. The reason you do that is you only need 3 pounds per square inch Right now you're breathing about 14 pounds per square inch, but of that, only 3 pounds per square inch is the oxygen that you need. So you don't need to breathe 14 pounds of oxygen. So this helps the amount of weight in terms of the oxygen you carry. So it's 100% oxygen, and something started to burn. It was an overload somewhere. The wiring, they didn't use Teflon wire like they do now, the Teflon coated wire, it started to burn. And like a flash, whoosh, just burned the inside of the whole capsule. They all suffocated. They didn't burn up. They suffocated. They were in their suits because they were asphyxiated from the smoke. So that set it back to the point where it almost canceled the program. And because Kennedy said we were going to do it, some of the politicians, and Johnson being one of them, said, no, this is going to happen. Many of them didn't want to go with it. Said, look, we can't do this. But they did. You know, it was a goal that was set, and we did it. So in July 1969, we landed on the moon. What happened in 1969 in the summer? Woodstock. Now, I had a choice to go to Woodstock or to stay home and watch this. Now, it didn't happen exactly the same days. Okay? No, I didn't. No, because my friend said, let's drive our bikes up to Woodstock, motorcycle, boo-boo. And I said, what's Woodstock? He says, it's going to be a great concert. It's going to be free. He says, the people are going to go. We're going to knock the gates down. We're just going to have fun. I said, what? Now, this is New England. You know how the sun always shines out here? The sun hardly ever shines there. It's like it always rains, right? You can count on rain. So now we're going to go to this field in a farm where it's rainy, which means it's probably going to be muddy, and there's going to be all these people on dope. And I'm saying to myself, I don't want to do that. So he went, and he said, oh, it was great. I didn't go, but I did when I was watching the moon stuff. I had my little place down in my parents' cellar that when I was younger, I practiced being an astronaut under the seat, under the stairs, you know, you make your little capsule. And I had a little TV, and I'm watching the first step of Neil Armstrong on TV, live from the moon. And what was neat is I went outside, looked up at the moon, and this feeling like, we're on the moon. There's a human being on the moon. This is what people have been trying to do since as far back in time as you can imagine. Here's the moon, and we're on it. And there was a really weird thing that happened in this entire on the planet when we were on the moon. Now, during this time, Vietnam was going strong, all right? So you got Vietnam going. People are nuts. There were race riots in cities. Los Angeles, they're burning places down, all right? You're too young. You think it's bad now. This is nothing. This is tame, all right? There were race riots. Schools were locked down because kids would be running through the corridors, beating each other over the head. And nobody really liked anybody. On that day, that you could feel the whole earth collectively doing like one of these, whoa. Do you feel that? It was incredible. There was like one day humanity stopped being nuts. And they appreciated that humanity did this. And what we did again, which no other country does this, when we went to the moon, we could have claimed the moon. Just like any explorer, boom, U.S. territory, stay away. Didn't happen. The prepared speech, NASA, of course. Neil Armstrong, and there's a plaque on the moon where they landed, and it says, for all mankind, for all humanity, we came in peace. Boom. Everybody, it was just crazy. And the day after, we went back to the stupidity. But on that one day, to feel the entire planet, I mean, that's the only thing you can describe. Like, everybody who had a TV was in front of it on this planet. All right? People in huts had TVs that could watch what was going on. And this sense of, we did that. We actually went off this planet to this other place.
Even in Red China, they had big TVs out.
Yeah. It was just crazy. So, you know, do I have hope in humanity? Yeah, because I've seen what we can do. Now we got to get the politicians on board. So that's my naive history up through the lunar landing. Now, as soon as we did this, we were supposed to go back to the moon. This was Apollo 11. We had six more flights planned for the moon. All right, they were canceled. We went back a couple more times, and the last three of them were canceled. Those rockets, the Saturn V rockets, laying on their sides in three locations, one down in Florida, one at in Georgia, and one up in Washington, I believe they have it, at D.C., at the Smithsonian. And this thing, 360 feet long, if you lay it down, fit in the football field out there. All right, just an enormous machine. And the sad part is, that technology that got us to the moon then, we don't have. All right, it's gone. So we had to reinvent all this technology again. And one of the things that always annoyed me is when I was a kid, I actually thought I'd be on the moon at some point in my life. But that didn't happen. As soon as we landed in Apollo 11, politicians said, okay, did that, that's it. All right, now let's go on to something else. But they missed the point because it was the one thing that united humanity, unlike anything that anybody could ever come up with. I mean, it's just amazing because every culture had in their culture somewhere this idea of, look, the moon is out there, you know, we want to touch it. And we did. So we did, 1969. And after that, we started doing experiments. We sent geologist Harrison Schmidt from New Mexico. He's in politics now. He's a geologist. He went and did real science on the moon. Geologist went there with his little hammer and took rock samples. And we got hundreds of pounds of rocks back from the moon, help us figure out a little bit more about the solar system. So it was good. Where are we now? Well, we got the space shuttle. I saw the third launch of that. NASA invited me to go down for that. And that was cool. There were over 1 million people lining all the roads into the Space Center on that day. And I was with one of the astronauts who went up on the sixth flight of the shuttle. And he was a colonel in the Air Force. And Peterson, his name is. And we were talking about that. We're on the bus. We had a special VIP bus that they took so you didn't go through the trafficy places and got to this special location. So I'm talking to him. I say, look, isn't this great? All these people here to watch the launch of the space shuttle. And he says, don't fool yourself. He says, this is like a NASCAR race. Most of them are here to want to see something bad happen. No. You know, I said, what an attitude. You know, he says, well, what are you going to do? That's probably true. Why do you think they're here? He says, I don't mean to sound so negative about it, but you see those people along the road selling the little blow-up space shuttle balloons? I says, yeah. He says, if you would ask them to donate $1 to the space program, you think they would? No. So, you know, it's like this mixed bag, yeah.
Have you been to NASA recently?
Recently? Which one? Where, in Houston?
One in Florida.
No.
They turned it into an amusement park, more or less.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was there last winter.
Wow.
The kid, they had like actual hands-on activities you do to see something.
Yeah.
The astronauts, it's just an amusement park. They had the rocket garden and Saturn V restored in the building.
But, oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, things have changed. NASA isn't what it started out to be. It's really, I'm very disappointed. I mean, I was like, yay, rah, rah. NASA didn't exist when we started our space program. And it turned into what it is, what it was then. And now it's just some political hacks.
National thing.
Yeah, so I don't know. It's not what it used to be. So, anyway, that's my thing. Where are we going next? Space station. We got that. That didn't turn out quite the way we had planned, but as soon as it's done, it's supposed to be deorbited.
Wait, what?
As soon as it's finished being built in a couple of years, they're ready to bring it back down.
Why?
I have no idea. I don't know. Why in the 70s when we had Skylab that Congress didn't appropriate the money to put engines on it to move it into a higher orbit, to save $100,000 and they have $1 million worth of machinery come down out of orbit, which was the first space station. So why? I don't know. I have no clue. All I can do is look at all the stupidity that happens and just shake my head. And then when it's time to vote, I try to vote for the one who's going to make sure we continue going. But that's all you can do, right? So it's the revenge of the C student. That's what it is. All right, any questions? Any other comments? Okay, I'll see you next time. Anyone have to sign up? Wait for me there.
I thought it was giraffe with a short open capsule.
No, it was...